We're going to get started with this sharing. And the focus today is on samadhi or concentration, which is one of the great liberating powers in this theme, this annual theme we've been exploring at Seattle Insight, this theme on transcendental dependent origination. I'm really looking forward to the discussion period or deconstructing this together. When it's time for a Q&A, I see that more as a deconstruction, a joint deconstruction. But I want to talk about what samadhi means, the meaning of the word samadhi in the Theravadin tradition, and what this means as it relates to right concentration and vitakavichara. Then realizing that a mind that is not concentrated may have a hard time awakening. And explain how concentration works, why it's really difficult in 2026 and beyond, in this modern context that we all live in, even if you might have lived in a different timeline, because that happens. If you've ever seen the movie Inception, that happens. But we really want to focus on practical constraints to concentration and how to nurture concentration in the context of this fragmented reality we live in, and at least from my perspective as a householder, and also touching on my kind of experience with this from retreat with Philip Moffat and Tuareg on concentration, and then realizing that concentration makes the heart divine and how it leads to the cessation of suffering through the embodiment of the Brahma Vihara. So hopefully I can do this in 25 to 30 minutes. But I want to start by saying, and anything I say, when I say you, I'm actually talking about me, I, right? And so if it resonates, fantastic. If it doesn't resonate, take what's useful and leave what's not. But I want to start by saying that a scattered mind cannot end suffering. A fragmented nervous system, to use more modern language, cannot find wholeness. It can only rearrange it. So a scattered mind may make better plans, may find better language, but a scattered mind cannot awaken fully. A scattered mind can learn concepts, memorize teachings, quote the Buddha, quote mystics. But if the mind is still scattered, it cannot see clearly. And if a mind scattered cannot see clearly, it cannot be free. This is why the Buddha placed concentration at the heart of the path, not concentration as a productive endeavor, not concentration as performance, not concentration as repression, even. And not concentration as trying to dominate the mind, but concentration as samadhi, the gathered mind, the collective mind, the unified mind. And the gathered mind is not a luxury, it is the threshold of awakening. Because when the mind is scattered, it sees through the lens of craving. When the mind is scattered, it sees through the lens of aversion. When my mind is scattered, it sees through trauma. When my mind is scattered, it sees through the nervous system's old survival predictions. But once my mind becomes gathered, it begins to see things as they actually are. Not as I thought they were. And when I see things as they actually are, suffering begins to lose its authority. So the question is, what exactly is samadhi? And I know a number of you already know it, but for the purpose of this talk, I will just repeat it. The word samadhi in Pali can be misleading. particularly in some of the translations to English. Because when I hear concentration, my old mind may think of school or work or productivity, getting things done. But that's not deep enough. Because in the early Theravadan context, samadhi is not simply focus. It is collectiveness. It is unification. Unification. It is one-pointedness of mind. And for the sake of full disclosure, once one-pointedness of mind is strictly focused on awakening in this very life, because I have no intentions of coming back. Even though the Bodhisattva vow from the Mahayana tradition says you come back and help and help and help other sentient beings. But from a Theravadan perspective, I no longer want to be at the lowest of the heavenly realms, which is the human realm. So therefore, my mind is consumed primarily with awakening and ridding myself of my own greed, hatred, and delusions. So anything that doesn't support that is a point of practice. But it's not part of the one-pointedness. Now, I'll go even further to quote a nun, Dhammadina, who spoke in the Kulavadela Sutta, which is in the Majjhima Nikaya 44. And she gave a very classical Theravadan definition of samadhi, which is one-pointedness of mind is concentration. So as you listen to me, whether there's resistance or openness, the only thing I would say is to you, what are you concentrating on primarily as you, as the not self or no self, as I prefer to say? What are you primarily concentrated on, Lauren? What are you primarily concentrated on, Faith? What is your mind filled with, Thomas? What do you think about all the time, Julie? So the Buddha certainly established this as true, what the nun Dhammadina said. And then she went even further to say that the four foundations of mindfulness are basis plus the four right efforts, which is to see arising, the neutralization, the cultivation. So samadhi is not about becoming blank, nor is it a trance. And a number of you may have already achieved the jhanas. Samadhi is not dissociation, nor is it being spiritually spaced out. It's about the mind becoming one-pointed, unified, and stable. And if you examine your own mind, your mind is always speaking. What is it speaking to you? Is it speaking liberation? Is it speaking remain in this loop that you're stuck in? Is it speaking projection? So samadhi is about collecting and bringing together to establish. So a mind that is collected and brought together is established. That's a mind no longer divided against itself. Or like the saying goes, once you deal with the enemy within, there's no enemy without. And all the enemies and demons and people you fight live right here in this gray matter. None of my enemies lived outside me. Not a single one. And I've had a number. None of them lived outside me, I found. Not from my family of origin. Not from the bullies I encountered. Not from the racism I've experienced, even as recently as a month ago in the parking lot at Seattle Insight from some folks from the Quakers. That is all inside me. That's what I call the gathered mind. The gathered mind is not evil. The scattered mind is light diffused in every direction. The concentrated mind is light passing through a lens. And when light is gathered, it can reveal what scattered light cannot see. Am I talking to you? If I'm talking to you, somebody give me a nod somewhere. This is a black part of me talking, right? Amen. No amen here. You can just nod. I see the waves, Judy. I see Suze. I see Lauren. I see the small Carol, Faith. You see Samadhi, and I see the Jerry. I see you, Jerry, Jerry, Jerry. I miss your smile, Jerry, Jerry. There's no one like you, Jerry. Most people know dependent origination as the teaching that explains how suffering arises, which is ignorance conditions formations, then the formations condition consciousness. Then the consciousness says, that's a name and form, that's him, that's her. Then I judge with my eyes, my mind, my feeling. Then contact conditions the way I feel, then feeling creates craving. Conversely, the Buddha also taught this liberating sequence, which is what we're focused on this year. Transcendental dependent origination. And in that, the Buddha talks about the proximate causes that leads to ultimate disenchantment. So we know that in order to become concentrated, you need to be happy. The proximate causes for concentration is sukha. So I'm going to ask you a question right now, if I may. Are you happy? Jeannie, you're so honest, Jeannie. Jerry, Faith, in and out. You see, it is hard to be human. It is very, very hard to be human. It is hard to be a baby. It is hard to be a tween. It is hard to be in your 20s when nothing means anything anymore. It is hard to be in your 30s when you realize the American dream is gone. It is hard to be in your 40s when you think, what the heck is going on? In the 50s, my goodness, my mortality is here. In your 70s and 80s, what's the meaning of all of this? But there's good news. There is good news. The good news is the moment you acknowledge the suffering, Faith, Jeannie, Jerry. See, I see your smile again, Jerry. That tells me you just overcame your manness. And this is based on nothing but a simple recognition. The happiness would not come from conditions outside me. The moment I make $1 billion, I'm thinking, how do I save it? How do I make $1.5 billion? Because the taxes and then this and that. So that's not going to do it. That's not, the new house. After 6 months, it just feels like another house. It's not going to do it. I'm going to project my suffering onto Jerry, but Jerry skillfully handles it. So I'm stuck with my suffering. So now I have to project it onto Judith. And then Judith says, don't play with me. So now I have to go find Shannon. When do I escape that loop? I escape it by simply acknowledging I am not happy now. And the recognition of that unhappiness is the conduit to the other side, if I'm to borrow from the law of polarity, because suffering is a precondition for liberation, even for those who spontaneously awakened. So concentration can become clear seeing if one nurtures the proximate causes of happiness that enables the mind to become one-pointed. And samadhi concentration is the bridge between settled happiness and liberating wisdom. See, the Buddha in the Jhanakaraniya Sutta said something really profound. That an ethical person, I paraphrase, does not need to wish May I have no regrets? May I have no regrets? May I have no regrets? No. It is natural that an ethical person has regrets, a moral person has regrets. But from non-remorse comes gladness. From acknowledging one's own shadows, one's suffering, comes gladness. Where else are you supposed to start? Where you are. So the important point here is the Buddha did not teach concentration as violence to the mind. You do not beat the mind into samadhi. You cultivate the conditions by which samadhi becomes natural. So we know that one of the proximate causes for samadhi is happiness. So what is in the way of your happiness? What is in the way of your sukha? Your real happiness, that's dependent on nothing but everything. How are you nurturing happiness and joy, pity in your life? Dependent on no new story, no new development about another wheel that's falling off. And I know we live in very kind of fluid, liquid times. That's the good news and the bad news. But I want to make a related point. Some of you may be aware of the work of Carl Jaspers. Carl Jaspers came up with this theory about what he calls the axial age. The first axial age happened 2,600 years ago. Just what happened? The Buddha came. There was affirming of Christ consciousness and the Christian faith, on and on and on. And Carl Jaspers, based on that allusion, argues we are now in a second axial age. Unprecedented. We are in an age that is almost a repetition of what happened 2,600 years ago. That's why the news stories are the way they are. That's why the retrogrades are happening the way they are. That's why the solar flashes on the earth is heating the way it is. That's why people are dying on Mars because of the sun. And this axial age is a new awakening. That hasn't happened in this way for 2,600 years. We almost got there in the 1960s, for those who actually lived through the 1960s. Remember the Beatles? Remember Woodstock? Remember Maharishi? Remember everybody focused on free love? And then something happened, exactly. And that recurrence in this axial age is what's happening if you're concentrated. If one is concentrated. But the Buddha also talks about concentration in the context of the Noble Eightfold Path. But I know that my own relationship with concentration started when I stopped concentrating on people pleasing other people, which was the bane of all my lifetime of trauma and narcissistic abuse and two divorces and on and on and on. And I started to prioritize how I felt, what I needed, who I was or wasn't. That concentration shifted everything for me. Concentration on what is wholesome, what is right. And I have a small confession. I have two or three bad habits, which I'm okay with. I'm okay with those bad habits. But beyond that, the concentration is on, if it doesn't bring the Dharma, it's a waste of time. It's practice. If it doesn't bring peace, it's a waste of time. If it's not connected to purpose, abject waste of time. If it's not with the right people, complete waste of time. Which is quite different from the open kind of boundaries, open borders that I had before. This yearning to people please and to be accepted and to be seen as amenable and amiable. Because I didn't like myself enough, so I needed someone else to focus on that for me. And this brings me to the quantum physics for a second, the observer effect. So there might be some physicists here, and you may understand this better than I do, but let me just throw this in for consideration. So before quantum physics, we all focused on the Newtonian paradigm that what is observed is what is science, right? If it's observed, we can explain it, that's what it is. The quantum world came and said, oh, wait a minute, what about the unobserved world? Are you saying if it's not observed, we can't talk about it? So that kind of threw that out way, right? I'm simplifying a bit. And in the quantum realm, it is the observer effect says everything is in potential until it's observed. And when it's observed, it comes alive. These atoms come alive. So can you imagine what you're concentrated on? Because whatever you're concentrated on, with the observer effect, you make alive. So what are you concentrated on? What are you bringing life to based on the power of your concentration? And let me demonstrate the power of your concentration to you for just a second. With your permission, if this is available to you, gently bring your attention to the area between your nostrils and your upper lip, and just be aware you're breathing or breathing is happening. And immediately notice what happens to you. This is the power of the observer effect. So easy to take for granted that whatever you focus on, you give life to. It moves from potentiality to actuality. Let me go even further. Everything in the space between you and I was once a thought, including this very Sangha meeting. So thought and attention makes things. There's nothing between you and I, everybody here, that wasn't once a thought, including my computer, including the building. Which is exists on architectural drafts, which existed in someone's mind. That's the power of concentration. So I choose to concentrate on the things that lead to my liberation. I choose to concentrate on the things that expose my greed, hatred, and delusion to me, so I become less greedy, less hateful, less aggressive. I concentrate on the things that expose my shadows to myself, so I walk around the world with the perfume of blamelessness. I concentrate on accepting myself, so my acceptance is dependent on nothing but me. So I can accept other people because I accept myself unconditionally. I concentrate on always being a beginner. So there are no egoic games to be played on this Dharma path. I concentrate on learning and going deeper into any wind of the Dharma that makes me less entangled to my past. An example is the Bodhisattva vow, even though it's Mahayana. That Bodhisattva vow has been so transformative in my Theravadin practice, I would say. So again, as I come to the end, when you think about deep concentration in the jhanas, what you're sustaining your attention to and what you're nurturing, the question is, what are you nurturing consciously and unconsciously that is supporting your samadhi? Because once the mind is deeply gathered, it no longer needs to be repeatedly placed and sustained in the same way. Where is my concentration? And is my concentration leading to a world, this new earth, that is more loving and kind? Or is it contributing to the distortions and hatred that exist in the world today? How am I? You know, to use the phrase from Dev Slavinsky, if I'm looking at Judith and I'm not thinking just like me, and I'm judging Judith, I'm part of the wars that are happening everywhere in the world. How can I be at peace with myself? How can I talk about world peace when I'm not at peace with myself, when I'm not concentrated on the peaceful things? I'm talking about me, not you, just to be clear. How can I speak about the Noble Eightfold Path when I'm using egoic and playing political power games all the time? Or creating smear campaigns? How can I say I'm practicing and concentrating on right speech when I'm threatened by someone, I create a smear campaign to bring them down? That is hatred. So that hatred begets more hatred. Worry begets more worry. Aversion begets more aversion. But joy, in the short term, you get resistance in the form of hate, but that's long-standing. Because the Buddha said, I have sat under this Bodhi tree and I've figured it out. So you can do it, but don't believe what I said. Ehipasiko. Ehipasiko. Find out for yourself. And by the way, I should say that my exposition of the Dharma may sometimes mimic an academic or a Baptist minister. Even if it rubs you the wrong way, it's still practice. I don't like the way he speaks, but what is it raising within me? Aversion. Okay, let me work on that. So it's still practice because, as Cheryl Malan would say, not me, not mine, not myself. Not me, not mine, not myself. So the world around us wants us to be fragmented, splintered, and scattered. And the revolution, Gil Scott Heron said in 1974 or 77, he said, the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised because it will be internal. Thank you for your kind attention. And now we'll just pause and open it up for comments, feedback, questions, discussion. I call it our deconstruction because we do it together. So whoever wants to jump in, just jump in and come as you are and come as you are and come as you are. And I'll yes, please.
This is Mike from Seattle. Thank you so much for your passion, your energy, your honesty, your openness, and your sharing how the Dharma is working in your life. That really speaks to me in a very powerful way.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you. And you know, the Dharma was good yesterday. It's good today. It will be good tomorrow. Right. And we are connected in different ways, but I would say that the moment I started connecting the Dharma, my old life fell apart. I've said it a number of times because my new life was coming together. And so this passion that you see is because it's changed my life, Mike. Yeah. It's changed my whole life.
Me too. Me too. I've been practicing meditation for maybe over 50 years now. And it is the one single reason that my mind has become free and spacious and empty, a vessel of just, you know, love and peace. And it's all thanks to the teachings that I have received over so many years.
That's so beautiful, Mike. And it comes through. I like to focus on energy. I'm an energy person. And I feel your energy. It's very beautiful energy, if I may.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, you know, we are essentially love. That's what we're made of.
I heard someone called Mike saying that.
Yeah.
That's
Thank you
beautiful.
so much for today.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you. Thank you. Suze, please.
I wanted to just speak to when you asked, you know, who's happy? And I am. And some of it was kind of basic temperament, but through my practice, every time I could see some of the crap inside of me more clearly, there was a moment of gladness. It's like, oh, like, you know, I was on a month-long retreat and had created such a bunch of garbage for myself. I had such a hard time. But when I saw it, the joy that showed up was really pretty remarkable. And then, of course, I saw it was gone, you know, boom. But the sense of appreciation of those moments of seeing clearly when I kept, you know, I kept on saying, why am I just having such a horrible time? I spend all this money, all this time to go to Massachusetts and have a month of meditation, and I'm a wreck, you know? And the Dharma invited me to just keep looking inside. And so I think that concentration on joy, rapture, tranquility, and happiness the 4 months before this, it's not an accident. It's not an accident that that comes first. And then there, that invitation that you gave us of, you know, what supports your concentration and what are you concentrated on? And that's such a good question. I'm going to carry that one with me. So big thanks to you.
Thank you, Susan. I really love what you said about, I got to this retreat and I'm a mess and it's all this suffering. And you remember the fast link in TDO is dukkha. That's the fast link to this transcendence, this path you just described that. That's exactly it. And seeing it directly, wow, what a blind spot I didn't know. Doesn't feel good, but I now see it. This is what I'm getting from what you just said. Shannon, please jump in.
Would you speak more of, you mentioned the Bodhisattva vow. Would you? I'm not familiar with it specifically.
Yes, I will. Thank you, Shannon. So this is, just to be very, very, very clear, this is very adjacent to our practice here, which is the Theravadin. This is from the Mahayana tradition. And the Bodhisattva vow essentially is this, four vows, plus 37 practices. And the 37 practices I actually got from a former Sangha member. Susan, you know who this is, from Spence, right? Spence Beard. He gave me these cards, these 37 cards. But I'll tell you what it is. The first one is, sentient beings are innumerable. I vow to save them all. The second, my desires are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. The third, the dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them. And the fourth, the Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it. Sentient beings are innumerable. I vow to save them. My desires are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. The dharmas are boundless. Look at the Pali Canon. I vow to master it. The Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it. See you, Shannon? Do you see it? That's what that is. So if you ever see me not espousing the Bodhisattva path, you have my full attention to say, Nana, you're full of crap. What are you doing? And that's to anyone who catches me not believing that. They say, what are you talking about? And I might say, I'm sorry, I'm wiping up my delusions. I'll be chumba. Is that helpful, Shannon?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, we'll go to Alana, then Faith, then Dan.
Thank you so much. This was so helpful. I feel like I've, taken a break from meditation because I've moved away from the Seattle area. But just sitting today, one of the things you just said, Nana, about the, like, I vow to say them all the sentient beings. And I thought for a minute about all my, you know, scattered parts of myself of like ADD sort of grasping and the attachment. And in this time that you mentioned that we have this awakening, I feel a lot of control aspects to myself want to fixate on that attachment, almost like freeze, like, cause I'm in shock about like how to move as quickly as maybe I want to, or feel as necessary based on what I'm seeing to kind of remove delusion. And so this helped me give a almost like container to it to get that fertile ground going. Cause I think I've stepped away from the concentration piece enough that I needed to ground back into a way forward. To just concentrate that light and get something kind of, doesn't have to be everything's perfectly aligned right now. It can just be seeing it and letting that light go out and kind of like the refractions sort of comes back together. So I just felt so relief and just ease from, you know, having that spoken to even with words, like name it to tame it. It felt like I resonated finally in a new area where I just don't know a lot of people. So thank you very much. That helped a lot. And I don't really have a question other than I guess I just really felt like it resonated finally to get back to it.
Yeah, that's very powerful here, Alana. And, you know, I don't know enough about the kind of science and mechanics of ADD or ADHD, but here's what I'll say, if I could make a blanket contribution. And I'll talk about neurodivergence as a whole. So what I've noticed or begin to learn about neurodivergences, neurodivergences actually see the whole thing. That's why you're neurodivergent, because what are you neurodivergent from? From what is neurotypical?
Right.
am I talking to you?
Very much.
So here it is. Right? My sense is, remember that it's not about browbeating my mind into concentration, but nurturing the proximate causes for it, right? So even if I can't concentrate normally because I'm overstimulated, right? But I do know how to get free. So what are the proximate causes for my liberation? And how do I get fixated on those in a healthy way, knowing that when I create the nurtured conditions, that the mystery of the Dharma does what it does. Like, you can't just say, I'm going to Nirvana and I'm going to, you know, raw dog it to Nirvana or Nirvana. Right?
It's, I've tried.
Yeah, try. Wow. Yeah, you can, right?
Yeah, you can for a long
you
time.
Try. You can try. What I found is just the being available online, Vitara Vichaka. And one's always doing that. You become skillful in merging between what's wholesome, unwholesome, or neither.
Okay.
And that skillfulness is in one area becomes useful in other areas, you know. And sometimes with the Dharma, it's just one component of it that makes sense to you, not the whole Pali Canon. It's just one word, and that's it. And that's the key word. So just responding to that, and thank you for your contribution, Ella. Really appreciate
thank you so much, Nana.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. The faith in that, please. Yeah.
I guess it's, yeah. Well, I, ADD, strikes again. But I was struck by, and I'm so appreciative of all you bring in that I may not understand. Because I don't know Mahayana, Hinayana, Buddhism. I know very little. But what struck me was when you brought in quantum theory, because I'm kind of addicted to that idea, even though I don't understand it. But it brings me to another thing that has brought suffering to me, is which I want to go out. I want to go out into the universe. And quantum, all those ideas help me do that. But what isn't happening is going in and down into myself. And that kind of meditation, rather than the wowie zowie universal kind of meditation, which I've done before. And so I so appreciate that you recognize that, and that you bring us back into ourselves and knowing ourselves and being ourselves. The whole "will you like me" syndrome. Oh, please. But so yeah, it's a beautiful talk. I love the whole Baptist intellectual combo. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That one of my heroes, and I think he's more AME, was Reverend Calvin Butts of the Abyssinia Church in New York. But I'd say this, to your point, Faith, you know, and some of the teachers here can correct me, Linda, Candace, others correct me, but there were 14 questions that the Buddha was known not to answer. I would say, no, these questions are good, but they don't lead to the cessation of suffering and the nurturing of kindness. So questions about, you know, ultimate reality and what happens to the universe and you die and all these things, right? They are interesting questions to consider, but if they don't bring you to the ending of your own suffering, then they're quite pointless, you see? And exactly. And it's all almost a form of bypassing. But if that can enable kind of the basic understanding that a 5-year-old or even a 20-year-old who's never sat in a classroom, or even a great teacher like Dipam Ma, who's not conventionally educated, right, and was mostly a householder, became this incredible Theravadan master, Dipam Ma, that comes from focusing on the things that reduce and eventually eliminate greed, hatred, and delusion. And if it's not doing that, then the nature of the universe is great to ponder, but you're still a mean person, right? You know, you can talk about the fancy Buddhist concepts, but you're not kind to yourself. And that is sort of inimical and antithetical to the cessation of suffering, seeing suffering and ending it in many ways. So I only bring in that insofar as it highlights that the observer effect, for example, that if you're not paying attention, if you pay attention to the thing, that's the thing. If you're not paying attention to the thing, then it's just background. And how do you navigate that in a way without getting caught up in concepts that lead to meaninglessness in a sense? So well said, how you pointed it out. It's about the everyday, the effort. Thank you. Dan, please, Dan.
So a couple of things you said were so valuable to me. One is, I'm still relatively new to this. And I've come to, as you were speaking, I thought, I have enormous concentration on, but it's rumination. I can go for extended periods of time focused on what I now realize is rumination. And I'm only slowly getting that this practice requires effort directed at being mindful, because I also don't pay any attention to the present moment, but I'm learning to do that a little. And I was moved by your saying, without concentration, I can't penetrate any of this. So now I feel like I will finish this morning reaffirmed in this idea that I have to make an effort to be mindful in the present moment and to be aware of your question, Daniel, what are you concentrating on? Because I'm concentrating on nonsense and pain and the past and the present. And I have enormous concentration for that crap, but it's not doing anything for my suffering. And now I'm getting clearer and clearer about the effort I think I need to make. Could you talk a little bit more about effort? Maybe that's obvious.
No. What you say is profound, and I also want to join you in saying that I'm also a beginner, very much a beginner. But I'll say this. I'll say this, Dan. Effort, right? Effort. So I'll make a lot of effort in being married to my trauma and my sense of righteous indignation. Then I also had a lot of mental effort towards, well, this is going well, but this might go wrong. There's also a lot of mental effort in thinking, this is really hard to do. That's why it's hard, and you have to try very hard. And so I became addicted to efforting on hard things and thinking things need to be hard to be worth the effort. But I learned something with the Dharma. The Dharma is about being available and aligned and using the factors of awakening. I'll just use one, investigation. What is going on here? Why am I having this sit? Why am I ruminating? Or I'm ruminating because I can be one-pointed. But why on this topic? Because I didn't resolve it 25 years ago. Oh, why didn't I resolve it 25 years ago? Because I wasn't aware of it and that thing happened and she said this. And then, so why didn't I resolve that? Because I didn't know it was there and now I know. So the quality of investigation shifts you away from just sitting for 45 minutes, 1 hour, 2 hours without realizing what's going on. Investigation as one. And that investigation would give you the energy to keep investigating more. And therefore the desire to show up again tomorrow to investigate again. And then on Tuesday as well. Then I get busy on Wednesday, so I don't. And I realize what kind of day I had on Wednesday. So I go back on Thursday. But then something else happens on Friday and I'm discombobulated. So I do it on Saturday. And then on Sunday. And then on Monday. And I learned these words from a teacher who said, on the awakening path, part of it is this, and a number of you already know this, is to start and continue. Start, Candace, you know this already, continue. And if you ever fall off, Jerry, even though I'm talking to Dan, if you ever fall off, begin again. Begin again. And soon, the gap between starting and continuing and beginning again is non-existent because your desire for investigation, for liberation, has become as fervent as avoiding bad breath, which is why you brush your teeth every morning, which is why one brushes their teeth every morning or eats or drinks water. It just becomes not something you do, something you are, because fundamentally what we are is spiritual beings having a human experience, as the saying goes. And so the more I orient towards this investigative quality with energy and interest, then I become established in understanding reality as it is, not as I think it is. And the more I see reality as it is, then I'm in this magical dance that makes me look like a crazy man with dreadlocks that nobody understands. Dan, I like your dreadlocks, Dan. Do you see what's happening here, Dan?
Yes.
What?
I see that the efforts that's needed. I think I see the direction in which to make the effort. And I think I'm getting a more realistic timeline about how long this effort will take.
Exactly. And the timeline is just based on, in my view, just being available and aligned and investigates with energy. And the mystery of the Dharma does what the Dharma does. There's a mystery to it. There is a mystery to it. As many teachers have said, there is a real mystery to it. That's what you're scratching on, Dan. I'm sensing. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you. Judith, please.
Thanks, Nana. Really enjoyed your talk, as always.
Thank you.
I just want to say to Dan, before I say what I actually wanted to say, is because he made me think of Rumi, our caravan is not a caravan of despair. Even though you've broken your vows 10,000 times, come again, right? But what I actually was thinking about is how often I am seeing my assumptions are wrong. My assumptions about other people, about myself, about situations. And this used to be very disconcerting when something I assumed was proven wrong. And now I'm finding it freeing because it's like, it's true. I really don't have to believe everything I think. And I guess it's part of the whole deconstruction of the conditioning, right?
So well said. So well said. So well said. I was having a chat with my son a couple of days ago. We watched the World Cup games together on the phone, and I was sensing some tension, and I've been sensing it for a while, but I was thinking it was one thing. And so I said, well, what's going on? What's this thing? And then he said, you know, Dad, I just want you to hear me and appreciate what I'm saying because I'm smart. And I felt so terrible. I didn't realize that was what, because I wanted him to know that my football knowledge was on par, but that's what he wanted. So that's the point you're saying. I think that what you're pointing to comes from practice, just being available to see one's own shadows. And the more you see, the freer you become, right? This is what I'm getting from what you're sharing, Judith. It's not what I think it is.
And it's a relief to know that my assumptions about this other person were wrong.
That's exactly right.
Right.
That's exactly right. That's exactly, just like I did with my son. And
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. It's really powerful to realize that what you thought was a snake was just black rope.
Right.
That's the saying goes. Yeah. That's it. Now, I just want to end with a short sit for the offering of merit. And if there's anyone you want to offer merit to, you can either type it in the chat or hold it energetically. May the merit of our practice this morning be shared by all beings so they may be free, remembering that our work is never for ourselves alone. Our work is never for ourselves alone. May all beings be safe and protected from harm. Sadhu, 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 sadhu.